The next case on for our oral argument this morning is in the matter of the application of USS Watertown Solar, as opposed to Water City Solar, for a conditional use permit. Council, I will just restate for the record that we are hearing this argument through WebEx, a technological tool that accommodates our concern about public safety in the middle of the pandemic. Parties are not present together in the same place, but we are making an audio recording of the proceedings, which will be available to the public as soon as practicable after the oral argument and posted on the judiciary's website. Council, each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional 5 minutes for relator for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready to proceed, please state your name and commence your argument with each leg. Council for the relator, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Timothy Kelly on behalf of relator. With respect to the 60-day rule issue, the administrative record in this appeal is identical to the administrative record in the Water City matter. There's one difference. And that one difference goes back to this office use only section of the CUP application. And the one difference is that you will see on that office use only section, there's a handwritten note by the county which states that an updated site plan was submitted by a relator on 2/5/19, so February 5th, 2019. There's no change in the office use only section to the application being checked complete as of January 14th, 2019. And there was no change to the March 15th, 2019, 60-day deadline noted in that section. So that is the only difference between the Watertown record, this case, and the Water City appeal, which we just argued. Now, I don't tend to, unless the court would like me to, restate the arguments we just had in the other matter, and I would rely on those arguments if that's permissible.
Mr. Kelly, just one question in a broader sense. We've been talking about the differences between material changes and not, and the clerical error or not, and whether the January receipt is the full application or not. And certainly you've both made good arguments about all of those, but they seem to be a little bit resolved, or I'm asking you if you think it is resolved by the language in the Harstead case that uses the phrase that automatic approval penalty is a harsh, extraordinary remedy. Is that perhaps a legal way to simply resolve it? Let's go on to the substance of it, because you've each made reasonable arguments about how to interpret the law as applied to these facts, but because it's a harsh remedy, we should get to the merits of the matter instead.
Well, I guess the automatic approval penalty, when the courts interpreted that, it's been limited to the timing requirement. There's been other cases which the county cites to saying that 1599 needs to be narrowly construed. But if you look at those cases, they're narrowly construed when they're looking at, does that automatic approval penalty apply to a government agency's failure to do contemporaneous findings, or given a written notice of the reason. And so I just hesitate to describe the automatic approval penalty as harsh as it applies to the failure to comply with the timing requirement. But because I think we've fully addressed the 1599 arguments, that's why there obviously are issues that relators raised that I think the court would rather hear me address those than repeat myself. Does that make sense?
That'd be fine. Thank you.
So, the relator, again, if you rule the relator's issue on the 60-day rule, or its analysis should stop. You don't need to reach the challenge to the denial of the conditional use. But if you do reach that issue, you should reverse the county's denial because the county acted arbitrarily and capricious. analyzing whether the county acted properly, two-step analysis. Court must determine whether the reasons given for denial were legally sufficient. And then step two, if legally sufficient, is there a factual basis? Now, in the county's notice of the denial, they give five reasons. And after each reason, they listed or identified the factual support for that reason. On appeal, the county cannot give additional reasons or add facts to the record. And that's exactly what the county has attempted to do in this case. I don't say this lightly, but you know, the county has the obligation to gather the administrative record and submit it to this court. Two documents they submitted were a City of Waterville 2017 housing study and the City of Waterville's comprehensive plan.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes.
And I'm going to apologize for taking you back to the argument. I just had an opportunity. Mr. Squires will have a chance to address this too, but I've had an opportunity, thanks to the magic of technology and the expertise of my law clerk, I was able to pull up Section 21, Subdivision 2 of the city ordinance. And I believe Mr. Squires was referring to that that section when he was talking about the requirements. And I'm going to read it, and I'd like Mr. Squires to address it too, because I do think it's sort of a threshold, significant threshold issue. So, A, an application for a conditional use permit shall be filed with on an official application form. And then it says the application shall, number one, include the name, address of the applicant, etc. Number two, shall be accompanied by. So there's an application, and then there's something in addition to the application. It shall be accompanied by such plans, elevations, and site plans as prescribed by the Planning Commission, and shall be filed at least 20 days prior to the hearing. So I'm just curious about what the parties think that means. Is it what shall be filed 20 days before the hearing? The application or the accompanying site plans?
I believe that, step back, when the relator submitted their application, you look at the boxes they checked. They included the three-page application form, and then all the other documents required, boxes are checked, including site plan. And so those were all submitted on January 14th, 2019. And again, applications deemed complete. What is missing from the statute, the county is trying to argue, is any specific requirement regarding the setback issue. There's no evidence that what provision the how the site plans did not comply with subdivision 2 of this ordinance. And again, just repeat myself one last time, hopefully, whether or not the application was incomplete still doesn't get county over the fact that when they extended the deadline, it ended on May 14th. They did not.
Okay, thank you. I don't want to have you use up all of your time restating the arguments, but I did find the provision, and Mr. Squires will have a chance also in his argument in chief to maybe discuss it more particularly.
Thank you. And I think this is an important point. Going back to the administrative record, they included this housing study and city comp plan, and then cited the housing study as concrete evidence that provided an additional basis for denial of the conditional, and cited the city's comprehensive plan as another basis supporting the board's denial. These two documents were never submitted or received by the county board during the application process. They could not have been relied upon by the county as part of the decision-making process. And on appeal, obviously what we're limited to is what was actually before the county when they made their decision. So the court should not consider those documents, and reject or not consider any arguments that relate to those documents. Now, going to the reasons for denial. Five reasons again. The first reason was the conditional use will be injurious to the use and enjoyment of other property in the immediate vicinity for the purposes already permitted, and substantially diminishes an impaired property value. So there's three conditions in that reason. Proposed use needs to be injurious to the use and to the enjoyment of other properties, and substantially diminish property value. The finding made by the board was simply the project is too close to current residential homes and will interfere with future development of the city of Waterville. There's no factual basis in the record for this project being injurious to other uses. Project creates no daily traffic. There's no loud noises associated with it. There's no lighting on the site, and it doesn't create any odor or dust. There's effective vegetative screening that already exists, so the person who lives closest can't even see the project site from his residence. As to property values, there's nothing in the record that shows solar farms or suggests solar farms negatively impact, let alone substantially diminish property value. That's the standard they were applying. We later submitted two analyses from Kirkland Appraisals and a local one from Chisago County, that both concluded that adjacency to solar farms does not have an impact on property values of residential uses. There's simply no evidence to support this reasoning. The second reason, and I'd say this is the heart of the matter the county hangs its hat on, is that the establishment of the conditional use will impede the normal and orderly development and improvement of surrounding vacant property for uses predominant. The finding here is that the location is too close to the city of Waterville and will impact future growth of the city. What's missing from the county's record is any link establishing solar farms and an impediment to development. Simply no evidence. The City of Odin case decided by this court in 2009 is on point. In that case, the county denied a conditional use permit to build a stabilization pond on the exact same ground. And the county had concluded that the stabilization pond would impede the normal and orderly development of surrounding vacant property. This court reversed, holding that none of the objectors had personally observed any problems with stabilization ponds that would affect property values or impede development. That's the exact situation we have here. You know, it appears that the county believes if you say solar farms and residential development in the same sentence, that alone is a sufficient basis to deny a conditional use permit. But the linchpin that's missing is any evidence, and this includes the City of Waterville letter and the city council member's testimony, they had personally observed any problems with solar farms impeding development. And as to the city, we have a county comprehensive plan, which was in the record, which designates an urban growth area for the city of Waterville. This project is outside of that growth area. The city of Waterville is not a metropolis, it's not Lakeville. And so you've got a growth area already designated and we're outside it. If this project site was in that growth area, we'd probably be having a different conversation about this finding. And again, we also have the evidence that later submitted that there's no impact on property values, which would also show there's no impediment to development. Sorry, I think my computer froze for a moment. Thank you. The third reason relates to adequate measures have not been taken to prevent odor, fumes, dust, or vibration will constitute a nuisance, and to control lighted signs in such a manner that no disturbance in the neighboring properties will result. There's absolutely no factual basis for this finding. The project doesn't cause odors, fumes, dust, or vibration, and there's no lights associated with it. The final two uses, or final two reasons, my time's running short, is that the conditional use is not consistent with the zoning ordinance and the comprehensive plan. These reasons are legally insufficient because they're not in the zoning ordinance, section 21, subdivision 2N, which sets the criteria for the county to approve a conditional use permit. You can't hold an applicant to a standard or a criterion that's not in the ordinance. This court has previously said the reasonableness of the county's actions is measured by whether or not they apply the appropriate criteria. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Yes, Your Honor, you wanted me to circle back briefly to the 50-day rule issue, and I'll address the question you had. I had a couple of
And for the benefit of the audio recording, let's go ahead and restate our names so that we can all keep track of who's making which argument.
Sorry, Your Honor. This is Jay Squires appearing on behalf of LeSueur County.
Thank you.
I had three comments, including it addressing the question you wanted to address on the 60-day rule case issue, which is, as Mr. Kelly indicated, identical really in this case to the prior case. The first comment is, I think, a point you made, Judge, and it's a very apt one, and that is that there is nothing in 1599 or case law that prevents a county, even where they checked or considered something to be complete, within that 15 business day period saying, you know what, it isn't complete, and they give the appropriate notice under that. The second point is the one you raised, Judge, and I was able to get that ordinance provision as well, section 21, subdivision 2.2. And what's significant to me, and I think the appropriate reading of this, is that the requirement for site plans here is that an applicant submits site plans, and it says essentially such site plans as may be required by the county. That slices in the favor of the argument and position I was taking. I think I used the word implicit, and you called me on that in a question. I think this makes it implicit. In fact, it makes it explicit that what is required for an application to be complete is such site plans as the county requires. So in this case, the county staff reached out to them and said, you know what, your site plan is not sufficient. We're requiring one that meets the requirements of the county's ordinance. The third point I wanted to make was a comment that was made by one of the other judges, and I think it's an apt one too. You know, this, you can slice this argument a number of different ways, even call it a toss-up at the end of the day. But if that's the case, then I think, as was pointed out, you bootstrap yourself back into Harstad, and that is the court's consistent recognition that automatic approval of a contentious land use request is a harsh remedy. And when you add all these other facts into it, where you can consider ambiguities, call it clerical error, call it computational error, try to dissect words within a communication and what a person intended, that harsh remedy in the holding in Harstad should side in favor of the county and its position in this case. So with that, I'd like to address the merits of the case, because again, we have the benefit of substantially identical reasons for denial in both of these two solar cases. And I'd like to really cut to the chase and focus on the fundamental difference between the parties. But I'd like to start out by saying that in terms of review, remember, all this court needs to do is find one legally sufficient reason, that's Trisco v. City of White Park, supported by some facts. A county or a municipality can give 20 reasons for denial, and you might reject 19 of them. But if at least one of the reasons is legally sufficient and there's some facts to support that reason, the decision must be upheld. And courts, in fact, say you're to defer to the county. Exercise your review in a limited and sparing fashion and not substitute your judgment. So even if you would have gone another way, you don't reverse the county as long as there's at least one legally sufficient reason supported by some record fact. I don't think we have a dispute on legal sufficiency of reasons. One of the things, and the thing I want to focus on in my time, is the impediment of this project on normal and orderly growth and development of the city of Waterville. I don't think the parties dispute that that's a legally sufficient reason for denial of a conditional use permit. We've cited Barton Contracting, Hubbard, other cases in our brief. Inconsistency of a request with a comprehensive plan. Parties don't dispute that's a legally sufficient reason. And again, we've cited the case law there. So what this case is all about, what these two cases are all about, are the factual basis for that particular determination. And there are some facts in both records in these two parallel appeals that support that. I'd like to first start with record document number 10. Record document number 10 is the city comment letter. And this comment letter was submitted again in both appeals. April 9, 1919. This is a letter giving the city's position on the consistency of the application with its plans and whether in the city's judgment, the solar proposal would interfere with orderly and normal growth of the city and the area. So what does that letter say? It says, in the city's judgment, the proposal will impact future residential development that is planned for the area. It says all of the property in this area is residential in nature. It indicates that the city's planned growth will be negatively affected. It indicates that given the nature of the city being essentially landlocked by two lakes on the east, on the north end, both in an east-west fashion, and being tied up by the existence of a state park and another solar project to the east, that the only area or direction of growth that the city can grow is to the south-southwest in the precise direction that both these solar farms were located. It indicates the city would be blocked if the CUP were granted. It indicates that the city has growth plans for the area contemplated by residential uses. It's not speculation and conjecture. It's offering to the county exactly what the specific effects would be given the existing city plans. It indicates that the city plans to extend water and sewer into this area, to and through the area. And I would analogize this to if you've ever heard the phrase leapfrog development, cities that oftentimes were on the fringe of the metro area where you have 5-acre lots where people like elbow room, people want to come in and develop 5-acre lots when the city is intending to, city is intending to continue to develop at an urban level of density as it grows out kind of like a bullseye. Someone proposes 5-acre lots around the perimeter. Well, that poses a problem because growth is stymied, because you can say, well, just continue the growth beyond that, but it's not feasible from a planning standpoint or economic standpoint to be able to do that. And in the same way, putting up solar farms serves as a barrier to the city's ability to extend its services and its growth through residential development.
Excuse me, Council, if I can interrupt. You mentioned these plans and development plans. Were any specific plans presented to the board or were made part of the record in terms of, I know there's references to schools, to water plants, to residential, but other than someone saying, we're planning this someday, is there any other specific evidence?
There were no specific plans, and I would say, Your Honor, in response to that, that this is a city that's providing that information. This is not a citizen and anecdotal comments. The county had the ability to be able to rely on the city saying, these are my plans, and just because the plans were not attached to that letter does not mean that that information should be ignored or carries no weight.
Is it relevant that the land in question is not part of the city boundaries?
No, it isn't, because cities grow by extending their boundaries. That's just the way it happens. Land is annexed. As cities grow, their boundaries are adjusted to reflect that continued growth. For that reason, it's not relevant just because it isn't in the city. The city's position that we plan to extend our boundaries and grow into that area is not inconsistent with the way things.
Mr. Squire, or go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, Brady.
Well, I was just curious, following that a bit, you mentioned there was no distinction between these plans, and yet this one is another mile further away from the grow section, as I understand it. That's my first part of my question. And secondly, in following up Judge Kalatowski's question, is it not appropriate for the county to inquire factually, besides just simply hearing it from a city? Can you tell us what plans you have? Are there any proposals? Is there anything more tangible? And if you could comment on the distinction between these two plans, given the difference in location.
Yes, in response to your first question, certainly this particular proposal is further to the south, although I would note that if you take Mr. Kelly's insert in his reply brief on this, this project is in very close proximity to what he identified as that other growth zone of the city. But certainly this one is further out, but it is in the same direction of the growth that the city says they have to grow by virtue of not being able to grow in any other direction. But I do concede this is further away. The first case, it was immediately adjacent to the city boundaries. I forgot the second part of your question. I'm sorry. Oh, you're muted.
You're muted there, Judge Slater.
Yep. Unmute.
How did I sound?
You sounded much better.
I was inquiring about the factual support. For instance, would it be reasonable for a county to inquire when's the recent development that you've actually had? What plans for future development? Is there even board minutes, school board minutes regarding a school, for example? Something tangible that we would then look at in a record. And in its absence, does not the law support Mr. Kelly's position? There's no factual basis.
Number one, the city is entitled to rely on information from a council member. Two, there are minutes in the record of the city council meetings where that's discussed. All of these facts, I would point to the Volunteers case, which is discussed in the party's brief. That was a case where the impact on the normal orderly growth was a sufficient basis for denial of a CUP. In that case, the city of St. Paul relied on the input of the Port Authority, which was the governing body over that particular industrial park in the city of St. Paul. That's all the case says. There was nothing further than the Port Authority providing its input on its opinion about how this was consistent with its plans. That CUP denial was upheld. So in that sense, the city offering this information through a letter is the same as the Port Authority offering its opinion on whether there was impediment. Now, the second document I wanted to talk about real quickly before my time expires is record document number 21, and that's the transcript. And this, I think, answers your question, Your Honor. And this is Mr. Roy McIntyre, who's a city council member, who came and provided additional testimony to the Planning Commission. He discussed the plans for a new school. Does the county have to say, we have to ignore that unless you provide evidence of that? Or do they have the ability to exercise their discretion and say, this is a council member who has knowledge of things and will credit? He said they plan to extend water and sewer into the area for residential uses. He expressed his opinion as a council member this would impede development. He told the county that the city and the City Economic Development Authority were working with three developers on subdivision plans for this area. He said the city, and this, thank you. He said the city, and I think, Judge, this answers your question. He advised the county that the city has a five-year plan and housing study to encourage residential development in this area. Now, this is important to me, and this kind of frames the issue for me. And this is, again, record document number 21. I think it may have been in the first case, but the transcripts are the same. The Planning Commission chair asked him questions that I think were very good questions to ask. And they were designed to, I think, assure her that he was not just providing anecdotal information or generalized fear or speculation. The chair asked, you're not coming up with these reasons simply because somebody wants a solar farm. That is part of the city's planning. Answer, solar farms was not part of our planning. question. So what you're talking about with the water treatment plant, the housing, that's part of your city plans? Answer, right, right. So I think that Planning Commission chair did a really good job in tying it back and getting this council member on record as saying, this information that I am providing to you on behalf of the city as a city council member is not anecdotal. These are tangible plans that we have for this particular area. So wrapping that up all together, I see my time is about up. Circling back to the standard of review in this case, is there a legally sufficient reason? Yes, I believe the parties don't dispute that. Are there some facts in the record that support that this solar project will have a negative impact on the orderly and normal anticipated or planned growth of the city of Waterville in this area? Yes, there are facts. Are there facts that this would be an impediment? Yes. And on the council member's testimony, I think to answer the judge's question, I would refer you to Eagle's Nest, which we cite in our brief, a case where a CUP was denied based on the normal negative impact on the orderly development. In that case, it was based on testimony of a Planning Commission member who happened to be on a Lakeshore Association. And he had knowledge, creditable knowledge of development patterns historically in the area and plans for the future. The court sustained that denial, finding that record evidence to be sufficient. That's no different than we have here. In fact, I would argue that this council member's testimony is much more creditable as a council member having the information he has to be shared with the county and serve as a basis for denial. So the Eagle's Nest case supports the testimonial record evidence on these points.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, just briefly. Thank you. Circle back to the 60-day rule. I think there was a statement that it's a toss-up, you should deny Relator's 60 rule claim and then arbitrary and capricious. Minnesota Supreme Court said in John versus Cook County, this is cited in our brief, that the time deadline provision of section 15.99 provides a consequence for the failure to act, and therefore is mandatory. So the 60-day rule applies and they miss the deadline, it's mandatory approval. Respect to arbitrary and capricious analysis, and there's a reference to city council meeting minutes. Again, I would submit that there's no evidence in the record that those meetings were actually received into evidence by the county. So we should not consider those. Mr. Squire cited the Volunteers of America case. I think this is the distinction between the two cases. In that case, the Court of Appeals held the evidence was reliable to support denial for the city's comprehensive plan explicitly referenced anticipated development in the project area. So, the distinction here is we have a comprehensive plan that everyone agrees designates an area for growth for the city of Waterville. As the court pointed out, this project site's approximately a mile after that. And so what's missing from the record is any detail of when is the city going to develop first in this growth area. Then once you have that growth area, when would you ever consider going outside of that? And there's still no explanation from the city councilman of why a solar farm would impede development. That's what the City of Odin case stands for. You can't simply say this use is going to impede this project. There has to be an explanation as to why. And as to the comprehensive plan, the board's finding, all it said was solar gardens are not specifically referenced in the plan. That was the factual basis for one of the reasons for denial. And I submit to you, I reviewed all the conditional uses listed in the zoning ordinance for this agricultural zoning district. There's 29. 25 out of 29 conditional uses were not specifically referenced in the county's comprehensive. So that factual basis has no relation to a reasonable, legally sufficient, or factual basis.
Before you run completely out of time, I wanted to give you at least a moment to address a concern that I've got with your equal protection argument. I know it wasn't the focus of the arguments in either case today, but certainly it's briefed by both parties. You rely, it looks like, almost exclusively on the Cacciotti case for the proposition that these are dissimilarly situated. But as I read Cacciotti, and you correct me if I'm wrong, there were two properties at issue, two applications at issue. The so-called Pennington properties and then the Plaza 41 application. And it seems to me that the court, in saying that there was dissimilarity in time, was just pointing to one of the factors that led the court to conclude that these properties were dissimilarly situated. There was the temporal difference, but the court went on to say, in addition, the Pennington property's application is not similarly situated to Cacciotti's application. And it gave the substantive reasons, much more substantive than just they were presented at different times. Likewise, the other property, the Plaza 41, it was the 3 points of the application that were materially dissimilar. Would you agree with me that the timing dissimilarity in Cacciotti was only one of the factors on which the court reached the conclusion that these applications were dissimilarly situated?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. And I think equal protection argument is that we have 6 prior CUPs for solar farms, 5 in the same zoning district. But then for these two projects, a basis for denial is that solar farms are not specifically referenced in the comprehensive. And so you can have temporal and factual differences between the projects, but that basis for why of denial doesn't make sense to treat all these projects differently.
Thank you. Your time has expired, and the matter has been both well argued and thoroughly argued since we managed to cover some of the same issues in both arguments. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you for your arguments, and thank you again, especially for tolerating the technological hiccups. But I think we got through it all, and we heard your arguments completely. I'm glad we didn't lose anyone in the process.
Thank you.
Thank you.